Good morning, I'm Tom Harrington. You're listening to the summer edition of The Current.
I was part of a group called C Street when I was in Washington. It was a, believe it or not, a Christian Bible study. Some folks that asked of members of Congress hard questions that I think were very, very important, and I've been working with them.
That was just one small part of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford's lengthy mea culpa for cheating on his wife. But for Jeff Charlotte, it was the mention of C Street, the group that Governor Sanford turned to for help, that was of crucial importance. For a month in 2002, Jeff Charlotte lived with the group, and his subsequent investigation into the fellowship resulted in his book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. He is also a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and Rolling Stone. Jeff Charlotte is in Rochester, New York this morning. Good morning.
Hi, Tom.
Jeff, let's start with your thoughts when you heard Mark Sanford's chat, and particularly when he referred to the counseling he sought at C Street. What did you think?
Well, it wasn't surprising. The Family is the oldest, most influential Christian right organization in Washington, and they've always specialized in the powerful. They're not interested in converting the masses, just only in political elites. And they also have sort of a sideline in fallen politicians. They reach out to guys who are in trouble, and Sanford fit the bill.
Now, your book is called The Family, and essentially, what is The Family?
Well, the group began way back in the Great Depression when the founder thought that he thought the Great Depression was a punishment from God for Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, for attempts to regulate the market. They take the idea of the invisible hand of the market, they take that very literally and think it belongs to God. He thought that God came to him and gave him a new vision, said that Christianity had been getting it wrong for 2,000 years by focusing on the poor and the weak and the suffering, the down and out, he called them, and that God had called him to be a missionary to and for the powerful, men like Governor Sanford.
Now, Governor Sanford is a governor, but I understand in Washington in particular, the family has a number of adherents, some of whom have been caught up in scandal. Who are some of them in recent times who've been caught up in the things that Mr. Sanford has been?
Well, the C Street house that Sanford refers to, it's a $2 million townhouse on Capitol Hill right near the offices of legislators that the family runs, and they provide below-market housing. It's registered as a church, so it's tax-exempt, and they're able to provide below-market housing to, at any given time, half a dozen congressmen. So Senator Ensign, also in the news for his affair, lived in the C Street house during his affair. The C Street house helped him cover up the affair, and then allegedly actually helped him arrange payments to his mistress. Another congressman, Chip Pickering, in the news now, apparently conducted his affair in the house, in the church that's registered as a or the house that's registered as a church for this congressman.
And there are other prominent, reading the book, there are clearly other more prominent politicians who've been involved with the family. Who are some of those names?
Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma actually was in the news because he helped Senator Ensign through his cover-up, you might put it. Senator James Inhofe, also of Oklahoma, has boasted of using the C Street House, which they're on one hand defending as just a personal prayer place, but on the other hand, he says, I use it to hold foreign policy meetings. He also travels around the world on the family's dime doing foreign policy. And at the same time representing the family, not American interests.
In the book, you write a line essentially saying that their plan, the family's plan, is more ambitious than Al-Qaeda's to establish a worldwide Sunni empire, which makes me wonder, what is their core ideology and what is their plan?
You know, a lot of people, when they hear about fundamentalist Christianity, they tend to think of, Bible thumpers and pulpit pounders and people who believe that Jesus is going to come back tomorrow, the rapture. The family comes out of a different theological tradition. They believe that Jesus can't come back until they establish 1,000 years of a Christian order around the world. So they're in it for the long term, and this gives them a mandate for politics. At one time, this was actually a liberal tradition in the 19th century. In the 20th century, it became a justification for really the expansion of United States power, which they see as the Christian capital of this new order that they're going to try and build.
So, Jeff, how does the family then fit into the typical view of what we call the religious right when we're watching from outside the states? Are they part of that?
they're close allies. But in fact, one of the arguments I'm making in the book is that we need to understand the religious right not as a monolith, but as a social movement with different tributaries feeding into it. There's the populace that were the televangelists that we see, and then there's the family, which really represents the elite tradition of fundamentalism, and that helps us understand why does fundamentalism endure. It's been, you know, these guys have been around for 70 years. Democrats win, Republicans win. It doesn't seem to matter. They don't go away. Mm. And they have similar interests but different approaches.
Now, you lived with the family for a period of time back in 2002. Tell me about that experience in particular. What struck you about the people who were living in the house with you, the members of the family?
They were wonderful people. I mean, the interesting thing about this organization, like any other, is that people get involved with the best of intentions. And here I'm talking about the ordinary lay people who are involved, not the politicians. I met Senator Ensign when I lived there, and it didn't impress me much then. Certainly doesn't impress me now. But the leadership had a very unusual way of explaining its approach. I sat in on a spiritual counseling session at the C Street House for Congressmen with a congressman named Todd Tehart from Kansas. And he had come in with some sort of typical religious right concerns. He didn't very opposed to abortion, although he expressed this. He says, how can the Christian win the race with the Muslim? He felt that Muslims are having too many babies. Christians were not having enough. His concern about abortion was relative. The leader of the group, the longtime leader of the group, Doug Coe, said, you need to have a bigger vision, a bigger vision than that. He said, well, what they're going for is what the family has traditionally called the totalitarianism of Christ. And he illustrated this. He says, here are some men who understood how to wield power. And this was a direct quote, Hitler, Pol Pot, Osama bin Laden, and Lenin. Now, he'd say these are evil men, but they are modeling power in the way that we think of power.
Wow. As we mentioned earlier, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, he went to the family for counseling. And here's the governor again, I think from that speech, his mea culpa, speaking about how he will handle the fallout from his infidelity.
And so I've been doing a lot of soul searching on that front. And what I find interesting is the story of David and the way in which he fell mightily, fell in very, very significant ways, but then picked up the pieces and built from there. And it really began with, first of all, a larger quest that I think are well expressed in the Book of Psalms.
So again, that was South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. Jeff Charlotte, you know, here's Governor Sanford quoting King David at the arguably the sort of the nadir of his political career. What's up with that?
Well, for one thing, we see that modesty is clearly not a virtue that they admire. But it really rang a bell for me. When I was living with the group and then my subsequent work in their archives, I discovered that this idea of the King David story, their understanding was a really core teaching of the group. David Coe, son of Doug Coe, and man has been in the news, a Senator Ensign spiritual advisor, once explained to me while I was there what King David meant to them. They admired him not for his virtues, but for, in fact, his failings. Remember, King David in the Bible seduces another man's wife and then has the man killed to clear the way for himself. And they look at that and they say that's what it means to be chosen. They believe that politicians that they work with are not elected by the voters, but selected by God. He illustrated that by turning to one young man being groomed for leadership, and he said, let me explain to you what it means to be chosen. He says, suppose I hear that you raped three little girls. What would I think of you? Mm. And this guy says, you know, of course. He says, you think I'm horrible. I'm awful. And David Coe says, no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't because you're chosen. And the idea is that when you're chosen, the normal rules don't apply. It doesn't mean that they want you to do these things, but good or bad, God has chosen you for power, and that's why Governor Sanford is still in office,
right?
And Senator Ensign decided that he wasn't going to resign either.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier the roots of the organization from the Great Depression of the 1930s, and one chapter in your book deals with the role that the battle between organized labor and business or capitalism also played in the development of the family. Tell me about that.
Yeah, they really began essentially as a union-busting organization. The founder was looking at the strikes in the 1930s. He thought these were a communist sort of satanic plot, organized a group of 19 businessmen who poured money into political candidates, and that was the beginning of the group. And then they slowly expanded onto the national stage and then the international stage. When you look at it and you look at the sort of the muscle, the political power they're able to put behind that in the 1940s, And you ask yourself why the United States, almost alone among major developed nations, really doesn't have an organized labor movement that is able to really balance management. I think we have to look at the overlooked role of fundamentalism, and this particularly kind of elite fundamentalism, in opposing that and representing what they call biblical capitalism, free market fundamentalism.
Now we're going to go completely out of left field right now, or maybe out of outer space. I'm going to play a little bit of a trailer from a classic 1958 sci-fi thriller. Listen.
It's indestructible. It's indescribable. Nothing can stop it.
This town is in danger.
How can it be stopped? Mob hysteria sweeps one city. Before long, the nation, and then the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of the Blob.
Starring Steve McQueen and a cast of exciting young people.
Love those exciting young people. That's from the trailer, the chiller thriller, The Blob, a classic. Jeff Charlotte, okay, what the heck is the relationship between that and the family?
I have to say, you know, I spent about 5 years researching this. They had dumped 600 boxes of documents in Billy Graham's center, and so I was going through those, interviewing people, and looking for references to something called the National Prayer Breakfast, which they created in 1953. And I happened to come across one, and a book about the history of science fiction and American culture. It turns out that the screenwriter of The Blob met the director of The Blob at the National Prayer Breakfast, that in fact he was an evangelical filmmaker who wanted to take his sort of political evangelical message mainstream. He needed a screenwriter. He had this idea, The Blob, and it was actually just a can of Jell-O, a red Jell-O. But of course it ends up becoming interpreted in American culture, in United States culture, as this metaphor for communism, you know, this blob. And so it's one of the more unusual fruits of the movement, but it's also very representative of their way of thinking about communism and the role that they played in the Cold War as they expanded overseas and started forging alliances with really some of the most brutal dictators, because they felt that communism was such a threat, it justified any brutality in response.
And can you give an example maybe of one of those alliances they formed with during the Cold War?
I think the worst is probably Suharto, the late dictator of Indonesia, who came to power in 65, 66 by killing, estimates vary, about 500,000 of his own fellow citizens. The CIA, not known as a bastion of leftist thinking, called it one of the worst mass killings in the 20th century. The family called it a spiritual revolution and began organizing delegations of congressmen and oil executives to go and pray with Suharto. Suharto was a Muslim, you have to understand. But what their feeling was that if they presented to him the person of Jesus, as represented by congressmen and oilmen, that he would understand that. And Suharto agreed in their archive, a memo to Nixon by Senator Mark Hatfield. He describes Suharto's response as, "This is wonderful. In this way, we convert ourselves. Nobody converts us." And at the same time, the money and the United States guns flowed to Indonesia, which he ultimately used to commit the East Timor genocide.
Incredible. Here's another bit of tape, more contemporary. This is from 20 years ago, 1989. The man speaking is Doug Coe. He is the leader of the family currently. I want to warn our listeners that some of this is kind of graphic.
I've seen pictures of the young men in the Red Guard. They would bring in this young man's mother. He would take an axe and cut her head off. They have to put the purposes of the Red Guard ahead of their father, mother, brother, sister, and their own life. That was a covenant, a pledge. That's what Jesus said.
That's a family leader, Doug Coe. So, Jeff, let's talk a bit about this man, Doug Coe. Who is he, and what do you think about what we just heard?
He's an Oregonian. He's about 81 years old today. He's been leading it since 1969. When he sort of took over in a power struggle for leadership. And what you just heard is really the boilerplate sermon. I heard it when I was there, too. They often use Mao or Hitler. Another thing Coe is fond of saying is, who are the three men in the 20th century who best understood the New Testament? And, you know, most people guess maybe Martin Luther King or Dietrich Bonhoeffer, or maybe if you're conservative, Billy Graham. He says, no, it's Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And he says the reason is that they understood that the theme of the New Testament is not love, mercy, justice, forgiveness. To the family, it's power. They really believe that. They're not being cynical about that. They think that's what God wants them To understand and to emulate this model of power.
Let's talk about the reach of this organization. There's a line in your book, you say, it's invisible because it's not in hiding, and which I thought was quite curious. It makes me wonder, how do you tell how big the reach is for the family, and who are the comrades of the family on the world stage?
Yeah, well, we have a few numbers. Chuck Colson, who is a Watergate felon who then was reborn through the family and became a major Christian right leader, he estimates the worldwide movement at about 20,000 people. They're not interested in a mass movement, you have to remember. They're interested only in these sort of chosen men. More recently, a conservative sociologist sympathetic to the family noted that there's about 350 full-time paid associates. Again, small. This is ministering only to the elite. And he did a survey of about 360 U.S. politicians, all national level politicians, saying, who's the most influential religious group in Washington? One in three named the family, which was more votes than any other group got,
wow,
which is astonishing given that this group denies that it exists. Another thing Doug Coe likes to say, he says, the more invisible you can make your organization, the more influence it will have. Which is true, which is why we have laws requiring lobbies to register and be accountable to the public.
And how do they make themselves invisible?
Basically by depending on the religious illiteracy of the American political press, I think, is really the issue. They're secretive, but you don't have to push too hard. There's 600 boxes of documents over at the Billy Graham Center. There's been investigations in the past. The LA Times in 2002... I teamed up with NBC News, and just last year we did a strong investigative segment. New Republic once upon a time did something. And the press never quite picks up on it because I think there's a bias. There's an assumption that fundamentalist means a kind of a big, sweaty Southern man standing at his pulpit and, you know, a Jerry Falwell type. And these guys are anything but that. They're sophisticated. They're in Washington. They're affluent. They don't fit the picture of fundamentalism, and so the press sort of neglects that until this summer, and the scandals of C Street have forced the family into the public eye.
Which makes me wonder, since that code of secrecy and that sense of invisibility maybe has dissipated somewhat, with all the publicity around these sex scandals that in the last few months, how do you think that's going to affect the awareness level of the family?
I mean, it's skyrocketed. I think almost sort of every major U.S. media venue has been dealing with it. This house on C Street, which is one of their key ministries, I mean, I think that's going to shut down. We now have three affairs there, all of them in which the family helped cover up the affair. What congressman moving to Washington is going to tell his wife, says, hey, I'm gonna move into that place with all the affairs, you know, where they help you cover up your mistress. So that's done. And what's been interesting also is that Doug Coe, it used to be when you spoke to a politician who was associated with Coe, they would say, oh, yeah, I know Doug. One of the fallout now is you have all these congressmen denying any connection with him. So Senator Mark Pryor is a pro-war, anti-labor Democrat from Arkansas, a conservative Democrat. When I spoke to him 2 years ago, he actually boasted of his connection. Hmm. He said through the family, he learned the meaning of bipartisanship was that Jesus didn't come to take sides. He came to take over. And now Senator Pryor's office is saying, oh, gosh, you know, we don't know Doug Coe and we don't want to be connected with that. And we have nothing to do with it. And, you know, frankly, that's fine by me. If they want to run from the guy who's looking at Hitler, Stalin, and Mao as a model of power, that's good news.
Hmm. In your research at all, and even in recent times, is there any kind of connection with the family and Canada and Canadian politicians?
There is, and this is going to be the subject of the next investigation I'm working on with my team of researchers and some other groups, watchdog groups like the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. Historically, they did try and create a Canadian branch. It wasn't their most successful. I mean, they've taken the model of the National Prayer Breakfast and recreated it around the globe from South Korea and Australia to even to Brazil, but they tend to be more successful where they have a dictator who finds a benefit for this. So right now, Museveni is the dictator of Uganda, is mm-hmm. their key man for Africa. And so they have a really strong operation there. Canada, you guys are pretty good with open democracy and transparency relative to the way they like to do things. So it hasn't been strong, but it is has been there, and that's going to be the subject of the next investigation.
You know, for people listening, they're hearing there's sort of a level of maybe it's kind of benign. It doesn't sound really threatening. And so what's the big deal? Why should we be worried if, either in the United States or globally about an organization like this? I mean, ultimately, what do you think the people of the United States and maybe the world should worry about the existence of this group, the family?
Look, if anybody's listening and thinks that a group that forged relationships with Papa Doc Duvalier, Suharto, Siad Barre in Somalia, Siad Barre in Somalia is a dictator. They sent Chuck Grassley, Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa, still serving over there, said, "Will you pray to Jesus with us?" And he said, "I will." And the documents in the archive said, "In return, I want my defense budget doubled. I want meetings with White House officials, and I want a hands-off policy while I look at some rebels in the north." Doug Coe and the family responded, in essence, done, done, and done. And so it was. And Somalia today is a lawless nation, completely destroyed. Barre used that defense budget, that boosted up defense budget to wage war on his own people. The family never declared him anything but a man of God, championed him in Washington. If you're out there and that sounds benign to you, then this is probably not a story of interest to you. But if you, that sounds disturbing, and further disturbing because this group really believes that they are not accountable to the public. As Senator Sam Brownback explained to me, when you get involved in the family, he's a member, you learn that how many constituents do you have? Is it the 2 million people of your state? No, only one. That's Jesus. How do you know what Jesus wants? Not even scripture, but by meeting behind closed doors with other chosen men. That's not democracy.
Jeff Charlotte, fascinating stuff. Really good to talk to you this morning. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Jeff Charlotte is the author of The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Stay with us on CBC Radio 1. Up next, it's The Late Show with host Gordon Pinsent. This afternoon at 1 o'clock, it's Wachtel and the Arts. And tonight at 10 on CBC Television, it's The National. But before we go... Canada's provincial premiers are meeting in Regina this week, and they have a lot on their minds. Protectionist trade policies in the U.S., swine flu, the state of Canadians' pensions, employment insurance reform, and getting their provinces back in the black after months of recession. Of course, at least one premier wishes he was back in black himself. New Brunswick Premier Sean Graham has publicly lamented the fact that attending the premier's meeting meant he was going to have to miss the AC/DC concert at Magnetic Hill in Moncton last night. So, Premier Graham, if you're listening, we have a special dedication for you. I'm Tom Harrington. This is my last day hosting the show. I'll be on As It Happens for the next couple of weeks. Next week, David Michael Lamb will be here. Thanks for listening to the summer edition of The Current. Have a great weekend.